he was really quite down on GPT 3 and 4, right? He was like, GPT 4 kind of sucks, is what he said. He's like, I don't think these things have changed the world, actually. Do you really think the economy is different now than it was before 3.5 and 4 came out? No. And his bar for AGI was that the economy after AGI is fundamentally different than before AGI. I thought it was quite interesting how dismissive he was of what they've released so far.
You're listening to the Startup Podcast. This is a Reacts episode. Industry insiders having frank debates about the latest tech, politics, and business news. Whether you're a founder, investor, or operator in a startup, you'll gain insights into how current events connect to broader themes and trends that impact your startup, your investments, and your day-to-day operational decisions. The conversation starts now.
Hi, I'm Yaniv Bernstein.
Hey, I'm Chris Saad.
Hi, I'm Amir Shavat.
Hi, I'm Emil Michael.
And welcome to this week's episode of the Startup Podcast Reacts. We've got a packed panel today. We've got Amir Shavat joining us, as well as Emil Michael. We are reacting to all the news of the day in tech, and I think this is absolutely the year of AI. And so we're focusing on a few things here. First of all, the OpenAI marketplace, off to a slow start. Rumors of Apple in negotiations with Google to use Gemini. What's that all about? NVIDIA's GTC annual conference, what have they announced? And what are the implications of that for the next year of AI and for founders working in AI? And finally, Chris did some homework. He listened to Lex Fridman's long-form interview with Sam Altman, which he found fascinating. You took a lot of notes, Chris, and we're going to discuss some of the highlights from that. All of that and much more just after the break. This episode of the Startup Podcast is brought to you by Vanta. You might know that sinking feeling. You're about to land a big contract when they ask about compliance. SOC 2, ISO, PCI, Essential 8. You've just snatched defeat from the jaws of victory. Not anymore. Vanta massively accelerates your compliance efforts and allows you to get those life-changing deals back on track. Don't wait until it's panic stations, though. Get started with Vanta today. They're offering 20% off their prices just for TSP listeners. Do yourself a favor. Hit pause, go to vanta.com/TSP, that's VANTA.com, to get that 20% off. Let's get straight into it. The first thing we wanted to talk about is OpenAI's marketplace for GPTs is reportedly off to a slow start.
Yeah, when I read that, it gave me like a head scratch because, first of all, I'm very bullish on the OpenAI marketplace. I think it's a great opportunity for developers, and it also takes time to build a marketplace. I've worked in multiple marketplaces in Android and in Slack, and it takes time. You need money, love, and fame. You need time to get developers to build stuff that is useful. You need time for users to discover and find the right solutions on top of that marketplace. And you need monetization capabilities that will come in the future. So I think there's a big bet. If I had to compare the bet of AI with what Apple is launching, I think OpenAI has a much, much bigger bet for developers. And I think off to a slow start is actually a good thing. We need to discover what's useful. We need to discover what will monetize. And it's one of the biggest opportunities I see for developers as a developer platform.
Amir, you're understating your resume a little bit, right? So you were involved in helping to build the Slack marketplace of bots, right? Which is one of its defining characteristics. I would argue one of its keys to its success. And you've been involved with a number of developer platforms and marketplaces, as have I, right? And so marketplaces are sort of our jam on this call, right? Including Emil. And so, you know, I think one of the defining characteristics of marketplaces is, as you're pointing to, they're way harder to bootstrap and take way longer to hit hockey stick curves than most people ever imagine. It is worth taking just a step back and explaining to the audience who may be living under a rock, what is this marketplace that OpenAI launched? What does it do? So they have this thing called GPTs, which are customizations of ChatGPT that make ChatGPT behave in certain ways because of functions you might configure, because of knowledge you might upload, because of instructions you might give it. This all tailors the ChatGPT behavior to be specialized, to be niched, to be unique to your brand or business or personality. And then they've created a marketplace where you can list your GPT and start conversations with these GPTs. As you started to allude to, Amir, a developer platform and a developer ecosystem and a marketplace need three key things. They need utility, something useful. They need distribution. So if you build this thing on top of us, we will put it in front of our users for you. And it requires revenue, right? We're going to pay you for that effort, that investment. And as you're alluding to, like, they're barely scratching the surface on all three things, right? There's very little utility. It's kind of lightweight customization. utility over and above what ChatGPT does, of course. ChatGPT has a lot of utility. There's very little distribution. It's just an app store. They're not putting bots in front of you and recommending bots and all this kind of stuff. And I don't think they've turned on the revenue monetization piece. And so this is an incomplete MVP product, and one would not expect it to have gone anywhere by now. Now, here's where I maybe differ slightly with you, right? So I love these kind of marketplaces. I was trying to build one at Uber. I think what you guys did at Slack is brilliant. But I'm actually a little skeptical about the GPT marketplace.
Okay.
Because to me, the power of ChatGPT is its natural language interface, its intuitiveness, its ability to grok what you're thinking or needing and implicitly and automatically and magically figure out what it needs to go do that. As designed today, where you have to kind of like pick which GPT you're going to talk to and explicitly make that choice and live in that niche world and have the cognitive load pushed back on the user, I think that's an anachronism to the AI super personal agent that just intuits what you need. So I'd be really curious what everybody thinks about that skepticism.
First of all, I'm curious, like one of the things that you said, Chris, is that ChatGPT has this intuitive interface. And the implication there is that chat is an intuitive interface. And it's something I'd actually potentially push back on, right? Like on the one hand, it's natural language. On the other hand, there's this uncanny valley where natural language is an interface we're used to using for speaking to people. And ChatGPT is not a person and it behaves in strange ways. And you never know what it's quite going to do, what it's going to be good at, what it's not going to be good at. Natural language chat interfaces lack any affordances, which is like a staple of UI. So my question is actually, is it a good interface? And where I think we agree is like, okay, then having lots of different chat interfaces that are different under the hood, but have the exact same interface, which is you just chat to it. It's actually quite a difficult mental model for users to grok. There's no differentiation of features or interactions. Just it will respond differently in a way that will be described. And then to riff on that, if that is to be successful, and Amir, you're bullish and much more experienced at this than me, but I wonder if there is still one of the things to be figured out is a marketing challenge for the individual GPT developers, which is, okay, if I'm building an application that differentiates itself only through how it responds to chat interactions, how do I succinctly market that? How do I package that up and explain it to people such that they see the value and they want to use my GPT? Because this is new, right? And I wonder if the first iterations really actually have nailed that way of getting people excited about using that specific product.
As the non-techiest person on the call, I browsed the app store, ChatGPT store, the developer shop, whatever you call it. And the stuff on there feels like derivations of what you would just do on ChatGPT and not clear that it's any different at this point. And yes, there's no monetization and that's a big deal. But when I think about it, I'm like, here's my quote. This is going to sound fancy, but I was like, I want a lie flat seat from Miami to LAX. There's a Kayak plugin or whatever you call it, and ChatGPT. I got the same answers from both. So what utility did I get from doing it in Kayak? In fact, by not doing it in Kayak, I was like, well, maybe I'm going to get an unbiased answer as opposed to a Kayak-only answer. So right now, it's not surprising that it's not taken off, but I do think that over the long term, this has to work, because if it doesn't, then all the value is going to accrue to DeepMind, OpenAI, and these big dogs. And with no ecosystem, the startup world's in trouble. So I'm hoping that the ecosystem develops. I haven't seen it yet, but I'm not like worried that it fundamentally is impossible. I just don't know what it looks like yet.
When I was an Android, the first app that raised $1 million or made $1 million was the Fart app, if you remember that.
Did we forget?
Where you can choose different fart noises on Android. So the first apps that made a lot of money on Android were really stupid and not a lot of utility. I think we're in the beginning of that. I agree with you. There could be two mental models, one AI that knows everything and I can talk to it in any way I like, or multiple personas like we have in our life. We have our legal person, we have our travel agent, we have our advisory, we have our finance guy, and all of these could be different personas. I more tend to think that we're going to have multiple personas because that's the way our mental model works with humans. So I would love to have multiple people who knows and like encapsulate the data and have my privacy and don't talk to me about my finance when I'm talking about my trip to Europe, because I want the best trip to Europe. I don't want to think about my finance. So that's the type of thing. I think we're going to have multiple personas, but in any of these world, I agree with Emil that we need an ecosystem. And I think an ecosystem will do a lot of good for OpenAI as well.
Actually, I was thinking as you folks were talking, because yes, I agree with both of you, there needs to be an ecosystem. But the question that was forming in my mind is OpenAI, is ChatGPT really a B2C platform, or is it more of a B2B platform? And what I mean is, yes, there's the model of the Apple App Store, the Slack App Store, whatever, but there's also the model of AWS or Google Cloud, right? As an end user, I don't go to AWS and say, oh, what great apps can I use, right? What they do is they offer a platform for app makers, but not the distribution. And even ChatGPT, like the history lesson there is, obviously, OpenAI was building GPT for quite a while, and ChatGPT was kind of not exactly an afterthought, but it was nearly a fun little hackathon sort of project where they're like, oh, you know, what if we put an interface in front of this thing we've built and see if people use it? And it just caught fire, right?
ChatGPT is a tech demo.
Exactly. So the point is, OpenAI wasn't conceived as a business to consumer, as a direct business, right? It was conceived as infrastructure, and infrastructure doesn't host consumer marketplaces. So I guess my question is, yes, it's going to be part of an ecosystem delivering value to the ecosystem. They need to be developer tools, but did that mean that they own distribution?
Yeah. So whether they intended to be a consumer business or not, they have a massive surface with a lot of attention and there's an opportunity there. So whether they're going to be the best at it, whether Microsoft or other app implementers will do a better job, it's a different story. I agree with you, Yanev, and I'm on record for many, many years now that chat is a suboptimal interface for many, many use cases. When I say chat is this elegant, intuitive interface, all I mean is it's doing a lot of things implicitly. Whereas the iPhone or the Slack store, that mental model of like, I need to install capabilities is, I think, different and of the last generation. And I think the future of these operating systems, of these interfaces, is more intuitive in the sense that they pick the API, the functionality, the capability, automatically authenticate, bill, and leverage third-party services, consume those services without you having to pre-install, pre-configure, pre-pay for those things. And actually, this has played out a little bit in the wild already. If you think about Alexa, which was very skills-based, and Google Assistant, which was much more, you configure it with connections and accounts, but it just worked. You didn't really install skills the same way as Alexa. But then just to turn to the utility question, the GPT thing didn't actually work for me. I tried to upload all my stuff and it had these limits that were not well defined. Whenever I asked it a question, like I was trying to make it act like me and answer as if I was the advisor, and it would never refer to the knowledge that I gave it. It would always make shit up and refer back to the general model. And so it actually wasn't working for me. In terms of the different personas, Amir, that you're talking about, my vision is it's just like her, right? It's an omniscient single being that I'm talking to, and I'm not sitting there installing, you know, switching GPTs. So I don't know. I think it'd be ideal for all of us that there's an ecosystem, but I'm not, as you said, Emil, I'm not convinced. I don't know what that looks like. I just don't know. I don't know how these top four companies just don't take the whole thing. I don't know what that looks like.
I love the movie Her, but there's some conversations that you don't want to do with the same person. And I'm anthropomorphizing AI here. But let's say you have her taking care of your banking situation, and then you want to buy a fancy car, and that her says, no, you can't buy this fancy car because your bank account is this and that. So there could be a world where you have multiple personas, and that's by design, and that's how you like it, right? Your coach tells you that one thing, and your helper tells you another thing. So I think time will tell which of these, but I'm personally very bullish on conversation.
Amir, do you think that what you type into Kayak's GPT on ChatGPT-4 is not leaking into what you type into Robinhood's GPT on ChatGPT-4? They're not connected?
I hope they're not. Or I hope that we will have the affordances to tell the AI what can leak and what can't leak. Just like you have with apps, you can say, hey, I want to share this information. I'm looking at the GPTs as basically apps that I can install on top of GPT, and I want to control the encapsulation of data there.
It's worse than that, actually, Emil. There's no leakage between chats. So the same GPT, you could have two or three chats with it, threads, and it has no effing clue what you said to it in the other chat because the context window is quite small and isolated by chat.
But hasn't Gemini made it stateless so that...
It's created larger context windows, but these are typically in the context of a chat. or of personalized instructions. But actually, on the pod today, we want to talk about the Sam Altman interview, and he actually says a lot about context windows and personalization over time. So that'll be an interesting segue for that as well.
You mentioned Gemini. Another bit of news that's happened this week, and it was a little bit funny. There was this paparazzi shot of Tim Cook and Sundar Pichai having like a slightly awkward looking dinner. And then it came out that there are pretty credible rumors that Apple and Google are in negotiations for Apple to use Gemini within its ecosystem. This is fascinating. There's been a lot of questions of like, what's Apple's AI strategy? And I remember all the way back to when Siri was first released, and there was a brief period where there was a ChatGPT-like excitement that you had this conversational agent that would do stuff for you, and it's a whole new world. And then Siri just sort of rotted for the next more than a decade. I do have a contrarian take on this that we'll come back to, but I'd love to hear people's thoughts on what this says about Apple's situation with respect to AI, that they are having these sorts of negotiations with Google.
I think they suck at CERT. That's why they're doing this. I think like the access to the AI is less of a thing and more the access to the data. And Google has the data. So when I think about utility, I use Siri on the car to call my kids, but I want to search a lot of things. And there's a lot of utility once you're connected to the web. And I think Google just provides that utility that Apple does not. Siri could become a lot smarter if it had Google AI. I just don't think they've made enough progress there to make Siri a very, very interesting counterpart to talk to. And I'm hopeful that this collaboration will make Siri a lot more useful for me.
You know, without knowing more, let's just take the rumors to be true. It feels like a strategic mistake for Apple to not invest in their own foundation models, etc. Because yes, Google has data, but Apple has a ton of data. They know where you're doing every minute of every day, whether you're sitting down, standing up, like what apps you access, who you call. Like there's a lot of data they have outside of the Google world. So yes, maybe they're going to trade both of those data sets. It's a little scary, but I feel like Apple's got like an infinite balance sheet, the ability to hire anyone in the world. And sure, maybe they're 18 months behind. Maybe they ought to buy Inflection. That seems like it's having problems right now because their CEO just left. I don't know. But it feels like to the extent they're seeding their willingness to invest in this as a standalone, feels like a strategic error. Even if as a user, it might end up being beneficial or useful to have both of these data sets merge.
Well, you know, apparently Apple has acquired more AI companies in the last 12, 48 months than all the other tech companies combined. So they're definitely using that balance sheet to acquire their way to competency. I think you're partially right on Apple has all the data. I'd say they have all the context. They know everything you're doing in real time, but I think they've demonstrated a real lack of competence around dealing with the aggregation of unstructured data and creating data-powered products from that. I think Google clearly outplays them on that front. But there's two things to note. One is Apple just released a white paper about MM1, their large language model, and actually have been incredibly transparent about that, more transparent than the other tech companies. And so they are working on their own large language model, which makes the Google conversation a little curious, right? It might be just throwing spaghetti at the wall, seeing how it might play out to build their own, how it might play out to talk to Google. Maybe they're published their own language model as a little leverage in the negotiation with Google. Like, hey, we could go build this ourselves, but what could you do for us? But I think the most important thing for me is that Apple is massively undervalued, I think, right now. I think all the other tech companies except Apple and Google have like hockey sticked. And I think Apple has an opportunity. They may not capitalize on the opportunity, but they have the opportunity to build the most incredible AI hardware the world has ever seen. Beautiful glasses, beautiful headphones, beautiful next generation smartphone devices that are not app-based, but are conversation-based or AI-based. And if they take this as a step function change platform shift and reorient all their hardware around AI, Apple could continue to be and accelerate even further as one of the most valuable companies in the world, thanks to AI. And I think that's not being baked into their stock price.
Chris, so the $2.7 trillion company being massively undervalued, it's a new one for me. But
come on, Yaniv. I'm saying the others have like hockey sticked thanks to AI.
This shows a weakness in Apple, that they haven't capitalized on AI and they're going over to Google. And Mary said, they suck at search. And it's funny you should mention search. In the rumors of this deal, it's not clear which direction the money is flowing, but Apple and Google have had a search partnership for a long time where Google provides the search for Apple. Apple is not paying Google for that. Google is paying Apple for that distribution. They are paying Apple $17 billion a year for that distribution. So it's pretty bloody epic. And I'd be fascinated to know in this negotiation which way the money is flowing and to what magnitude. But I wouldn't be surprised that this is effectively an extension of that search distribution deal where we've talked in previous episodes, and many others have, about Google kind of flubbing this whole AI opportunity too, and, you know, not locking up their natural technological advantage. And so there's two ways to look at this. You can say, well, Apple missed an opportunity with search. They've outsourced it to Google, and sure, they get paid for it, but if they'd in-housed it, they could have benefited even more. Or you could say Apple is a company that is strategically focused. They know what they're good at. They know what they're not good at. They stick to their knitting, and then they capitalize on their distribution by partnering with best-in-class companies to provide the services that they're not good at. So that's my contrarian take, is like, this is Apple being really smart, and sure, they're acquiring AI companies, already building like AI mobile chips and whatever. They'll make sure that their devices are the best place to do inference and stuff like that. But the actual technology underlying that, the software side, Apple have never been good at like deep software. They've been pretty good at building operating systems, and that's about it. And so you say, well, why should we try to get good at something that's not in our DNA when instead we can partner with someone who's really bloody good at the tech and shit at distribution, and we get synergies? Like, isn't that what big companies do? They partner for synergy.
I mean, Apple partners to a point, right? Like, they slowly but surely become very, very good at the full stack and just let go of partnerships one after the other after
not
the other.
Not search.
No, not search.
Not search.
Not search. And when I saw them do the new macOS search bar and Spotlight, and I saw them do the AirPods, I thought they were about to make a big power play of disintermediating Google and building their own search and rerouting all this. So, and they didn't do any of that. But I'm talking about, like, they're happy to take over the chips. They're happy to take over the modems. They're happy to take over, like, they own the hardware in that iPhone soup to nuts in a way that most Android manufacturers do not. And they're doing the same thing on the software stack to a degree, but they've never gone into search.
Apple are a hardware company, right? And to the extent that they are very good at software, they're very good at software that enhances the experience of using their hardware.
Tim, Apple would disagree with you, to quote Trump.
Why would we think
they think of themselves as a software, hardware, and services company, right? They think of themselves as like a vertically integrated thing, right? They want to be good at everything.
There's two other options. One of them is that this whole thing is not actually happening and they just met for dinner. And the other one is that this could be a switch, because I think if you look at the interaction with LLM, with AI, it's kind of vanilla. It's very commoditized. And I've seen developers replace one AI model with another AI model, giving users the same user experience. So it could be that Apple just like short circuits for a few years using Google AI while developing their own model and then switching, just not being late to the party. So this could be another short circuit for a business reason.
Look, if I think about this from a business point of view, yeah, they're getting a lot of money from Google on search. But Apple saw a strategic threat in Google Maps and spent billions developing Apple Maps. So it's like you get addicted to the crack of the free Google high margin search revenue share. But then do you worry that long term, if the device just becomes a link to whatever the best AI is, let's just say use Chris's vision. It's like the device becomes less of a device that hosts apps and more of a device that just connects to an AI cloud. That's very threatening for an Apple, because then the hardware becomes much more commodity based and easier to do. And therefore, if I were them, I would probably at a minimum be pursuing a mirror strategy, which is parallelizing it and investing as fast as I could and maybe partnering in the meantime. But letting go of this wave seems very dangerous for an Apple to me.
Yeah, agreed.
I don't think that the vision I painted necessarily makes the AI, let's assume the cloud-based AI, but it may also be client-side. I don't think it automatically makes it accessible from every device. So I think Apple still wants to control the Apple AI, let's call it Siri 2.0. They still want to control HealthKit. They still want to control the stuff that makes Apple uniquely Apple at the software and services layer. And they still want to control the hardware layer, that no one builds better consumer hardware than Apple. And so they want to control the hardware layer. I think there's still a way to create lock-in there that's like a uniquely Apple AI agent with a uniquely Apple set of hardware, and they're all vertically integrated. I don't think it necessarily follows that if the device is just referencing a cloud intelligence and the device becomes disposable, I think they still vertically integrate that the way Apple does. But it does require quite a bit of nuance and thoughtfulness in the way they play it all out. I agree with you, Emil.
Again, with an infinite balance sheet, but you do all this stuff. You just like do it all, right?
There's more to it than balance sheet, right? Like it's still an element of focus. I mean, we didn't really talk about Apple canceling their car, but they did just do that. Right. You know, one of the things that Steve Jobs did when he came back to Apple, which I think they've managed to do a pretty good job of keeping in their corporate DNA, is being focused. Like for a company that, yes, has an infinite balance sheet, Emil, they don't do very much. They only have a pretty small set of products that they build. And that's kind of what they do.
They also canceled a while back, they canceled Apple Ads, which is again, another Google competitor. So could be that they're going to be frenemies. I would never imagine that when I worked at Android to have like good, serious deals with Apple. But yeah, who knows?
But that's actually a funny thing, Amir, is Apple and Google were really close. They were friends. They weren't frenemies until Google saw the threat from iPhone and did Android. Android was the point. Like Eric Schmidt was on Apple's board while he was CEO of Google. And then he left because of Android, right? Steve Jobs basically kicked him off. I mean, maybe this is a really interesting historical through line where Apple and Google are actually a fantastic combination. And at various times, the competitive positionings, like in the era of mobile, pushed them apart. And now that Android and iOS are a kind of a duopoly where both of them are comfortable and neither of them's going anywhere, that competitive pressure's gone away. And they naturally become friends again. They're very complementary skill sets as companies. And so maybe the future is Apple and Google being really close partners.
Knowing everything about us.
This episode of the Startup Podcast is brought to you by Vanta. The team at Vanta are passionate about helping you secure your business by vastly cutting down on the time to get compliant with frameworks like ISO 27001, SOC 2, and Essential 8. Vanta lets you close deals, sleep better at night, and get back to building your product. Help yourself and help the podcast by going to vanta.com/TSP for an exclusive 20% off deal. Okay, we're staying with AI because I guess the world of tech news these days really is focused on AI. So NVIDIA had GTC, which is their annual conference where they've announced a new generation GPU called the B200 Tensor GPU. And they are claiming that it can be up to 30 times faster on inference, I think 5 times faster on training, but also 25 times more energy efficient. And so, you know, I think that's pretty bloody significant in an era where when you sort of look at the industry, a lot of the constraints around AI are actually hardware and energy constraints. GPUs from NVIDIA have been the new kind of digital gold in startups. This is a massive bloody leap in terms of capability. So what do we think about that?
I'm going to play the optimist in this episode. I'm really bullish on NVIDIA and what they're building. It feels to me like they're like the Dune. They're building the spice that everybody's consuming. That's the mental model that I have in my brain. I think that their revolution here is good for the world because like if you remember how many CPUs and how much energy was generated during the crypto madness, it used to be that like the entire energy of the US was consumed when creating like the first waves of crypto. And I think here, if this could do the same thing for reducing the carbon footprint, making it faster and cheaper and more economic to train models, this is a great technology that powers AI. It's going to power the rest of the tech. So I was very happy when I saw that. And I look for more of these jumps that are much, much bigger than Moore's Law in terms of our ability to do computation. So happy with that event announcement.
I mean, there's nothing to be not happy about. It's like Everyone wins.
What do we think, guys? Is NVIDIA undervalued too?
No, but it does. This is all goodness, except who's number two and where the hell are they on this NVIDIA competitor thing? Right. And are we, you know, is the world like, holy crap, this is a new TSMC where like the world's like dependent on this one company for the future of mankind or what?
That's Dune for you. That's what wars are made of.
Yeah, I don't think there is a number two at the moment. And the double-edged sword is it appears that NVIDIA are executing very well, which makes it very hard for a number two to catch up. And this is not an area where I have the deep technical expertise. Maybe we can bring back our friend of the pod, Ali Reza Ali, to talk about this. But yes, my understanding is they're executing very well. The other announcement at this GTC that caught my eye was something called NIM, which is software. And this is the interesting thing, right? So I don't understand this enough, but this is effectively kind of a cloud software package for AI, which is apparently important and really, again, best in class. And so NVIDIA are, I guess they're kind of like Intel in their heyday. You know, my understanding is Intel's advantage in its heyday was not just their superiority in like chip architecture and in fabs, but actually around the software around developing their chips, for example, in those days with motherboard design and things like that. And my understanding is NVIDIA have a massive lead, not just in AI hardware, but in the software that goes around AI hardware. So that's another moat that they've built and are continuing to build really well. So I think this is fascinating. Yes. That sort of geopolitical concentration risk thing again. Yeah. Supply chain is extremely concentrated. It's like NVIDIA, TSMC, ASML. Those three, like our entire AI future depends on those three companies continuing to operate the way they are.
But they're in such a stable and peaceful part of the world. So why are we worried?
On the hardware side, I found the announcement relatively, it might sound weird to say this, but relatively prosaic. Like Moore's law is going to Moore's law. And every now and then we beat the curve a little bit. And every now and then we undershoot the curve a little bit, like whatever. It got faster, no shit. Yes, NVIDIA does want to be a big dog in software. To some degree, it is a big dog in software, but I am not connected enough to the technology to understand, is some of that smoke and mirrors and just weird storytelling and like pretending like it's a big dog, or and some of it is actually fundamental moats around its business. I don't know enough to know, but it's definitely trying to tell a software story. That's for sure. In terms of the single vendor risk, I don't think NVIDIA is the problem. I think TSMC is the problem. And TSMC is behind NVIDIA, right? Like, so it's not TSMC and NVIDIA. It's TSMC is the problem. And if TSMC gets taken off the board, we are fucked. NVIDIA is fucked. Everybody's totally fucked, right? And so right. I just think people talk about that in such like they blow by it, or they laugh about it, or they like mention it as an interesting quirk of geopolitics. It's like, it is a catastrophic strategic weakness for the West. You know, put aside Israel, Palestine, put aside Ukraine, Russia. Like, it's more important than anything, I think. And I don't think we talk about it in those terms enough outside of maybe, I don't know, the halls of power in Washington, I would hope. But yeah, it's so, so important.
You're right. It's spice.
What drives me crazy about this too, Chris, is that TSMC is supposed to build this plant in Arizona and the local government can't get out of their own way to let them just build the effing plant. And it's like, oh, you union labor, blah, 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 blah. And they're like, okay, we'll build it in Japan. And you're like, okay, well, Japan's better than Taiwan. But if the politicians do their job, they would clear the decks, be like, here, come to Arizona, whatever you want, as fast as you possibly can. But they can't seem to like get out of their own way on stuff. It's disappointing.
Look, Biden's done the CHIPS Act and whatever, but it really feels like we keep fighting last generation and last era's wars, right? Ideological wars and physical wars. We're still fighting Russia. We're still arguing about Israel's strategic position and whatever. It's like, what about the chips? Like, what about our ability to compute? What about, instead of unconditional aid to Ukraine and to whatever, like, what about unconditional aid to setting up a TSMC in the US? Like, how about that?
What about, instead of waiting for China to invade Taiwan, the US can invade Taiwan? Fine.
And that's how World War III started.
Chris, I know you have listened to Lex Fridman's long-form interview of Sam Altman. You've taken a bunch of notes and you have some nuggets that you wanted to discuss. So why don't you set this one up for us?
I actually did like homework. I went through the entire thing and took notes and grouped them into categories. I don't know why I'm putting so much effort into this whole thing. There's a lot of topics we could pull out. Maybe let's just talk about the hottest of the hot, things that feel new to me, that feel worth debating. So the first is, he talked about the idea that the board saga and him getting fired was interesting to him because he felt like the road to AGI should be a complicated power struggle, or rather, not that it should, but it's unsurprising to him that there will be power struggles on that road. And he felt like he was relatively unsurprised by that. And he was happy that it happened early on. And he didn't rule out more power struggles either at OpenAI or other companies. But I thought he was incredibly self-aware and honest when Lex asked him, like, why should we trust you with this whole AGI thing? And he said, you know, in some ways, this whole board saga was a failure of governance. I can no longer look you in the eye and say, look, the board can fire me at any time because they tried that and it didn't work. I thought that was incredibly clear-eyed and incredibly honest. That was one of the things I wanted to discuss out of his interview that was really interesting. And then I wanted to unpack with you guys.
Yeah, that is a self-aware point, right? He had a power struggle with the board where he won. which means if he wants to be able to say that he is the CEO of a well-governed company, he needs to somehow allow a board with teeth to be formed rather than a sort of Elon Musk Tesla style board where clearly the CEO is in control.
I've seen a few boards. I don't have high hopes for boards as a structure of governance. I've seen boards fail completely multiple times. The question that was asked is really important. Like, if we have an AI that is actually an absolute power that is much more intelligent than us, who controls it? And I don't think Sam Altman is the person to control it. And I don't think the board of any companies is the board to control it. I think this is going to be either a regulatory thing if you ask the Europeans, or it's going to be like a business regulation thing if you ask the Americans. But I don't think a single board or a single person will be able to control this if it truly becomes a general AI.
You just can't pass up a chance to hate on Elon, can you, Yaniv? Just can't do it, man. His Patsy board that helped him build a $600 billion company. Yeah, what dopes. I'm joking a little bit. But you guys read the law report, like the investigation of OpenAI. Did you guys read it? Like the results of the investigation? They hired WilmerHale to do an investigation like Uber did with Eric Holder, one of these like absurdly expensive, intrusive things. And the board came back and was like, yeah, there was some lost trust. That's why they fired him. It was a failure of idiot board members. It was not a failure of governance. It was a failure that the people didn't know what they were doing. They made flip decisions. Now he's got a legit board. He's got Larry Summers. He's got Brett. I forget his name, but he was Twitter chairman, who's a well-respected leader. They've got the person who ran Bill Gates' nonprofit. They have now a legit board with experienced people who are not going to do dumb shit. So when he said it was a failure because they couldn't fire me, no, it was a failure because they could fire him because they were morons. Now he's got a board. And if they fire him again, it'll probably be for a legit reason.
I think that the takeaway I had from it was he comes across so honest and earnest and thoughtful and transparent to a degree that I find suspicious. It's just like to volunteer that, hey, I now can't fully look you in the eye and say, hey, well, the board can fire me. And this on the face of it could look like a failure of governance, and it could look like I usurped the board's power. I think a lot of other CEOs and certainly a lot of other politicians would have talked around that and said what you said, Emil, like now we have a real board and they can do. But he just straight up and said it. So let's cover another nugget from the interview. Speaking about next generation models and upgrades to GPT, he said, A, he thinks that AI should be able to think harder about harder problems, because there's this thing recently that's come out. It's like, hey, if you ask GPT a really hard question or a really simple question, it spends the same amount of compute time to figure out the tokens. And that suggests that it's not thinking hard enough about hard problems. And he believes that that should change. But he also said, we're not ready to talk about Q-star. And he said that very abruptly, like not denying its existence or whatever. He's like, yep, we're not ready to talk about that. I'm not going to talk about that. And he also said, there is a GPT-5. It will come out. He honestly doesn't know when, but between now and then, there are a lot of amazing new models to come out and a lot of breakthroughs to be released, including something significant this year. Not GPT-5, but something significant this year, which I had not heard anywhere else, and I thought was super interesting.
What I really liked about what he said is he focused on the things that really matter, I think, to a lot of users, which is the randomness. If you ask ChatGPT 10 times, it will give you 10 different answers, and it needs to give you a single answer that is consistent in the right answer. I thought that was like really customer focus of him. So I don't need the next number for the GPT. I need the stochastic aspect of ChatGPT to be more consistent, and I need the answers to be better and aligned with the task at hand. So I think he nailed down the key pains that they need to resolve, regardless of version.
But just very interestingly, he was really quite down on GPT 3 and 4, right? He was like, he said GPT 4 kind of sucks, is what he said. He's like, I don't think these things have changed the world, actually. Do you really think the economy is different now than it was before 3.5 and 4 came out? No. And his bar for AGI was that the economy after AGI is fundamentally different than before AGI. I thought it was quite interesting how dismissive he was of what they've released so far.
I think it's indicative of his ambition. And it was a couple of episodes ago, guys, where I was again being maybe a little bit of the contrarian or the devil's advocate there, where I'm like, has AI really been that successful yet? And what if it hits a wall and never quite achieves its ambition? And I think Sam's like, yeah, you know, it's great, but we're nowhere close to having something that is fundamentally world-changing. We've got a lot of work to do. And it's similar like in crypto, which you all know I'm pretty cynical about, but the one person who seems to have his head screwed on straight is Vitalik, the kind of inventor of Ethereum. And he's always gone on and said, we have not earned our stripes here. Like as a crypto community, whatever we've built, it's not changed the world. So let's get off our high horse and keep building. And I think Sam's doing the same thing here. He's like, let's not get caught up in the hype. There's a lot of problems still. It's magical technology, but there's a lot of problems still. And if we cannot solve them, if we do not solve them, then the impact of this technology will be relatively limited compared to what it could be.
What a great leader. Sounds like he got fired for the wrong reasons.
They're idiotic. No questions there.
All right. And the last nugget we can talk about is speaking about disrupting the economy, disrupting the world. He said that he doesn't think about ChatGPT disrupting jobs right now. He thinks about it as disrupting tasks. And the question is, how many tasks can it do and how complicated are those tasks? And he believes that over time, it needs to get better at doing more and more tasks and more abstract tasks. And it will continue to be a tool for people with jobs for quite a while yet. And then ultimately, he sees a future where these things have bigger and bigger context windows, to our point about context windows and personalization. And he wants a system that encapsulates multiple models that gets to know you better over the course of your life and just gets smarter, more intuitive, what I would describe as kind of omniscient and clear about who you are and what your persona and priorities are and gives you what you need when you need it at the time you need it. Amir, to our debate earlier about like, hey, is this multiple GPTs or one universal persona?
I think from a regulator perspective, he can't say anything else. Because if he's going to talk about like AI is going to take jobs, that's going to be the easiest way to get the regulator to knock on this door. And I think tasks is a easy cop out. But at the end of the day, every job is a list of tasks. Like I'm a VC, I maybe have 10 tasks and you've done with my job. So I think that tasks are the gateway drug to take people's job. And I don't think it's a bad thing, but it's definitely a thing that we need to recognize. So I'm not with him 100% there.
I think you're right that ultimately jobs are collections of tasks, but they're collections of tasks with a layer of human judgment and abstract thinking that is important to differentiate. I think saying that Sam Altman is worried about regulators coming alive to what he's doing is a little bit weird, right? Like he's almost like begged them to come knock on his, he's knocked on their door, right? So I don't think his primary agenda is to avoid regulators knocking on his door. I think he's genuinely saying that like, you need to deconflate or deconstruct or decouple this idea of like, what jobs can we disrupt? Because as you said, the gateway drug or the atomic unit of a job is tasks, and we need to deal with it at the task level right now as a matter of architecture, as a matter of product, as a matter of conceptually thinking about this thing for the short to medium term.
I think we're splitting atoms here. I think that it is clear to me that like we're not far in time away from disrupting the call center that does customer care calls. That employs a shit ton of people in lots of countries around the world. That is like happening as we speak. Again, it's sort of inevitable and it just is. But I think what I would interpret what he's saying is like, I'm talking about white collar jobs. He's like, we're not replacing lawyers and accountants and bankers just yet. And he's right. I think he's right. But that doesn't mean it's not 2, 3, 5 years away. And that's when the regulators go bananas because those people have political power. And that European regulator, the AI guy, do you see him? Like the white-haired theory guy who's like tweets at Elon Musk. It like terrifies me that Europe has this like pre-regulation regime. And so yes, I think he's probably saying like, don't worry, we're not coming for you. We're heading to India, Bangalore right now.
Yep.
That's where AI is like first going to have its impact, because once it comes to the European white collar jobs, yes, there will be a massive freak out.
You know, there was the brief period in the 16-month whirlwind since ChatGPT was released where it was all about these ChatGPT agents. Do you remember that? Where it was these tools that were using AI to create, to break down a bigger task into smaller tasks and then sequentially execute those.
The most famous one was called AutoGPT.
Right, exactly. And they seem to have faded from view a little bit. I don't know why. But to your point, Amir, which I think I agree with you, is the distinction between a job and a task is simply the level of abstraction. And if you can use generative AI to itself, break down a job into its constituent tasks and then execute those tasks, you know, that's what an agent is. Well, isn't that what doing a job is? Like, isn't that, you know, as knowledge workers, when we say, okay, this is the outcome we want, how do we achieve that outcome? We break it down to a bunch of discrete projects and break those projects down to a bunch of discrete tasks. And then we execute those. It seems to me like maybe the quality is not there yet, but the actual concept of being able to operate at multiple levels of granularity is something that these AI systems can already do.
Just to close my mental model here, it's like if you ever worked in a big corporate like Facebook or Google or any of these, you have people working with a lot of vendors, and those vendors do small things. So you're like, you're a marketing manager and you have a vendor that creates the logos and a vendor that creates the copy and a vendor, and you're like overlooking all these vendors. Basically, these are the tasks, right? And AI is going to be the vendors, and all humans are going to have the same service level that a big rich corporate is going to have through these agents. The problem, to Emil's point, is that this is going to take jobs. We're saying tasks, but at the end of the day, it's going to be jobs, starting maybe in India, but going all the way to Europe and taking white collar jobs.
I mean, it's already, again, if you're designing a website today, you could probably design it instead of paying $50,000 or using GoDaddy to like put the blocks, you know, whatever. You could probably do it for nearly free now today. So that the it's just going to start at the bottom of the pyramid, and it's going to creep up over time with the ability to reason and put different concepts together the way humans do. But yeah, it sort of feels inevitable that that will happen over time, right, Chris?
It feels inevitable. I think it is inevitable that it will disrupt jobs, and it has already disrupted jobs. The point I was making, and I think the point he was making, is from a product point of view and from a specificity point of view, it is more precise to say these are tasks, not jobs, because jobs and employees in jobs require intentionality, intuition. The work and the tasks are non-linear. They require social interaction and cohesion and collaboration. And so if I'm a product manager at OpenAI, the direction I'm giving my team is, your job is not to go build employee replacements, digital twins of human beings. Your job is to make this an incredible tool that can be supervised by and directed by human beings who have jobs. Now, that might be a subtle distinction that over time becomes less and less important, but I think it's an important one as you're moving up that stack, up that pyramid, up those abstraction layers. And so I just thought it was a little glimpse at the specificity by which they're thinking about this. And they're not boiling the ocean. They're thinking of it as a tool rather than a person replacer at this phase in the evolution of the technology.
Hey guys, that seems like a good place to wrap up. Amir, Emil, thanks so much for joining us. If people want to follow you or get in touch online, where can they find you?
I'm very promiscuous. You can find me in any platform, including Blue Sky, Twitter, Facebook, everywhere. I'm at Aishavat.
I don't have a Blue Sky handle, but you can find me on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Emil Michael.
You can find me at Chris Stard on all the social media. I note for the record that Amir still calls it Twitter, as I do. We're brothers in arms on that. But all the social media, Twitter, LinkedIn, what have you.
And I am, I guess, most active on LinkedIn. But if you want to see my spicier, trollier side, I am on Twitter, at Y Bernstein. So that's a bit of fun, too. Now, folks, if you're a regular listener and getting value out of the Startup Podcast, don't forget, you have implicitly signed up to the Pact. So we really trust you, our listeners who get value from what we do, to honor this. What the Pact is really simple. It's not a lot of work. It won't cost you anything. We would like you to follow us and rate us in your favorite listening app and on YouTube, and also to give us a shout out on your favorite social media app, wherever you have an audience, and make sure as many founders as possible can find us. All right, gents, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for coming on. Until the next time.
Thank you for having us.
See you later. Bye-bye.
This episode of the Startup Podcast was brought to you by Vanta. Vanta helps businesses get and stay compliant by automating up to 90% of the work for the most in-demand compliance frameworks. With over 200 integrations, you can easily monitor and secure the tools your business relies on. Head to vanta.com/TSP for 20% off their incredible offering and start unlocking extra revenue today.